Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is the role and impact of independent film? Doug Becker explores and then, with his guests, recommends some of the best lesser-known independent films.
I'm Doug Becker. American iconic actor and film director Robert Redford passed away on September the 16th. Now, conversations about his remarkable life and career have typically focused on his on-screen work, his remarkable behind-the-screen directing, but perhaps his greatest impact on film and culture around the world and in the United States is his support of independent film. In 1981, Redford established the Sundance Institute to support independent filmmaking, and 4 years later, the Institute takes over the U.S. Film Festival and eventually is going to rename this the Sundance Film Festival, something that those of us who love film have all heard of. While not the first of these independent film festivals, there's a lot of them around the world, Sundance really became well known as an avenue for independent filmmakers, and that would broaden the voices and visions of people with access to the film industry. So on today's show, in honor of Redford's contribution to independent film, we're going to explore the impact of independent film, of the film festivals that will produce this independent film, how these films get made, and what's been the impact of the development of independent film on the broader cinema industry and culture. Our panel today is Sherry Ortner. She is Distinguished Research Professor of Anthropology at UCLA. She's the author of Not Hollywood, Independent Film at the Twilight of the American Dream, and most recently, Screening Social Justice, Brave New Films, and Documentary Activism. Cynthia Barron is professor in the Department of Theater and Film at Bowling Green State University. She's the author of Modern Acting, The Lost Chapter of American Film and Theater, and the co-author of Acting Indie, Industry, Aesthetics, and Performances, with Yanis Siomakis. And Dan Mirvish, he's a director, screenwriter, producer, and author. He's directed 13 films, including 18 and a Half and Bernard and Huey, and has written The Cheerful Subversive's Guide to Independent Filmmaking. Thank you all so very much for joining us. And Sherry, I think I'll start with you. You've written quite a bit about the advent of independent film. What has been the impact of the development and growth of independent film on American cinema and on cinema broadly?
I think it's been tremendous. And I think at this point, it's almost, I don't want to say invisible, but it has merged into into Hollywood so much that and affected Hollywood filmmaking so much that it's hard to remember that it was so oppositional in the first place. So it was born against Hollywood. That's why I called the book Not Hollywood. It was just born to say everything that Hollywood doesn't say and to kind of say it in a way that Hollywood doesn't say it, to tell stories that Hollywood doesn't tell and to perform them and present them in completely radical ways, sometimes very disturbing, sometimes funny, sometimes, but always you'd sit there and you'd watch it. I remember in the early years when I started watching it, you sit there and you watch it and you're like, none of this is what I expected to see in a movie, you know, and it just was different. So it had a huge impact. And Sundance, just to sort of refer to that, Sundance, as you said, wasn't the first film festival, but it just, it took off. And there was a kind of conjunction there in the late 80s where the filmmakers were making these fantastically new kinds of movies. And Redford was open to that. And Redford wanted to promote that and make that visible. So that's basically the kind of turning point. And then you get several decades of this amazing kind of different filmmaking. Eventually, as I say, it started to impact in both directions. On the one hand, independent film got a little bit more Hollywoodized sometimes. On the other hand, Hollywood got a little weirder, a little more radical sometimes too. So it went both ways.
Well, I want to delve into those, but Cynthia, I want to turn to you. And ask sort of the same question and specific examples, also with a specific eye towards, I mean, who wasn't being heard and wasn't being seen prior to independent film that suddenly found more avenues to having their films seen?
There's a short answer, there's a long answer. I'll try to sort of hit in between. When we talk about independent film, contemporary American independent cinema as sort of a marketing concept or as a discursive notion. I mean, it arrives in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s. It definitely, as Sherry points out, is a response to the beginning of franchises and so forth. And there's a lot of funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, American Playhouse, these sorts of things. And so it is aesthetically and culturally distinct and oppositional. And you move into the 90s, and it's kicked off by the financial success of Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And there's a kind of movement towards a more, I don't want to say commercialized, but certainly there's more visibility, a little bit higher budgets, more attention to genre, and the studios move in with their specialty divisions, and they push out the independent distributors, and things do change. And then once you get to the 2000s, two things happen at once. One is that again, as Sherry points out, the movement towards Hollywood escalates with something like Magnolia, which comes out in 1999. We're talking about a film with a $37 million budget that's still called independent, and it's like, at what point is this independent? So a lot of people refer to that trajectory as Indiewood. And at the same time, this is a moment when the arrival of digital cinema happens. And so there's another thread that parallels Indiewood, which is sometimes called the Indie 2.0 thread. And it goes back very much to filmmaking that is under $1 million. And it has aesthetics and cultural specificity that is very distinct from Hollywood. So, the people who, what does independent mean? I mean, if you go back to the very first independent films, those were the separate cinema of Black cinema. And so it is always in the US, it has been the folks who have been closed out of mainstream cinema. And then even in the once you get to the sound era, it's films that are made in non-English languages, you know, Hungarian, you know, in so the people who are not able to be to fit in to Hollywood's vision.
I'm going to circle back and delve into what it means to be indie, because as somebody who watches a lot of film, I'm always struggling with what makes a film an independent film. I want to bring Dan in because, Dan, you've made films. You are an indie filmmaker. So what does it mean as a from a filmmaker's perspective? What has independent film meant for you? What makes a film indie from the perspective of a filmmaker?
It's funny because we call it independent, but it's really dependent. In fact, Ted Hope, big indie film producer, is now starting to call it non-indie film instead of indie film for non-dependent or something like that. But yeah, it means that you are independently greenlighting yourself, basically, as a filmmaker. You are not reliant on some studio or some big financing entity to greenlight you, and then you are beholden to them, and then they own the copyright too. Real independent film means basically I go out, I raise the money, I crowdfund, I find rich people on boats and wineries and on horseback, and I ask them for money, and then they give it to me, but I'm the one who ultimately has it, creative control over the film itself. And yeah, what Cynthia and Sherry were talking about, as film became, as indie film became Indiewood or Hollywoodized in the mid 90s, that's when you were seeing films made with huge budgets. And really, did the filmmaker still have control over what they were making? You know, the means of production and or distribution. So that's kind of how I think of independent film, is it's less about what the budget is than how you got the budget. I mean, in a sense, you know, you could argue that James Cameron is an independent filmmaker when he made Titanic, and he had two, and he played off the domestic rights with one studio and the foreign rights with the other studio, and he got $100 million from one and $100 million from the other, but he got to make the movie that he wanted to make.
Right.
That's no different than an indie filmmaker shooting on their iPhone, and they get $5,000 from Uncle Harry and $5,000 from Aunt Judith, and they make the film they want to make. So some of it's about budget and some of it's just about the attitude too.
Dan, I guess I'll ask you first and kind of, you know, go around them, because we have this notion of like indie film houses, right? Maybe this is the indie wood part of that. Cause when I think of indie, obviously Emil, what comes to mind is something like Miramax. Miramax was doing indie films, but they're spending a lot of money. First of all, is that fair to say that that we have sort of indie filmmakers? I know some of the big studios have their own sort of independent labels. Was it Fox and then Fox Searchlight? Fox Searchlight is described as indie. Is that really indie, or is that just different marketing?
It's a bit of both. I mean, Cynthia is the real historian here on this. But since I was around then, the mid-90s was really when that indie would thing change was happening. It was around 94, 95, 96 that Miramax became part of Disney. Fine Line became part of Warner Brothers. Fox was launching Fox Searchlight at Sundance 95. So that was when Hollywood realized, hey, these are the films that are winning Oscars and winning awards, and that can be good business and good prestige for us. And instead of doing it ourselves, why don't we just buy these companies and you know, co-opt them from the inside out. Now, of course, that led to all kinds of excesses and Harvey Weinstein doing horrible things to people. And you know, there's a lot of reasons why that was not such a good idea. But and that period kind of only lasted about, I don't know, 5 or 7 years, until then the studios were like, nah, never mind. You know, and they got rid of those divisions, or they sort of morphed them into other things. I mean, Searchlight and Focus are still there, but they're not making little movies anymore, and they're not distributing little movies anymore, whereas they were. On the other hand, Sony Pictures Classics, Sony's division, you know, with Tom Barker and Bernard and those guys, they, you know, they've been around for 30 years, and Sony lets them do their thing, and they're a kind of a renegade little division within Sony. So, you know, they're as independent as it comes, and yet they're part of the, you know, biggest funded studio in the world. So,
And Sherry, what we're describing here is something that you brought up, in that indie became a way to challenge the studios, but the studios became more indie. Is this what you're describing, in the sense, I mean, in some cases, they literally were creating their own independent studios because they wanted this independent feel? And Dan actually raised an issue here that immediately came to mind here, is that indie films kept winning awards. Was that the primary motivation, or were they trying to co-opt potential rivalries, or what's the process here where indie goes mainstream, mainstream goes indie?
So I'm probably not the right person to answer that question. You know, what I mainly look at are the resonances between the work, the films, and the larger culture, and kind of the social and cultural exchanges that go on with film. So maybe leave that question to somebody else. I couldn't get my foot in the door of a studio. I tried, actually, as an anthropologist, I tried to get access to studios and to do some ethnography in the studios as well as with independent filmmakers. I could not get in the door. So
that's a fair, very fair response. Cynthia, you were talking about IndieWood. What is that process then of the big studios becoming more indie, the indie studios becoming more, you know, more mainstream, and how much was this driven by awards?
Well, there's two pieces. There is an interest in prestige, right? I mean, for example, there's a collection of films that are quality, low-budget films that win Oscars. Moonlight, Coda, many more. But at any rate, so there's the prestige aspect. But the other piece is just plain money. And the idea is that if you have a film that is, has a budget of $1 or $2 or $3 million and makes $100 million, let's say like Get Out, the studios love that. And it's also just holding complete control over market share. The studios did the same. They had the same sort of response when they were figuring out that non-quality, low budget, maybe exploitative filmmaking had a big cut of the market, and the studios went crazy, and they're like, "No, we want it," and they start producing material that is to cut those. Studio, producers like AIP and so forth. It just drives them crazy if they don't control everything. So, it's a couple different things. And if it is your job to make money, that's what you do. You cut everybody out of the market. No shade. I mean, that's just what they're designed to do. So,
yeah. A reminder, it's called show business.
Yes, that's their job. So it's not like they're evil. That's what their shareholders want, right? That's mm-hmm. anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about independent film in light of the death of Robert Redford and his incredible commitment to independent film and his sponsoring of the Sundance Film Festival. Our guests today are Sherry Ortner of UCLA, Cynthia Barron of Bowling Straight University, and Dan Mervish. He's a director, screenwriter, producer, and author. And also you're at Chapman University, right?
Yeah, part-time faculty at Chapman.
Very, very good. Dan, you mentioned that as a filmmaker, when you are doing independent film, you are the one going out and getting the money, and then you have control over that. But as a filmmaker, most independent directors are also producers, right? So they're responsible for actually going out and getting the money. How much of your time is spent just trying to track down how to pay the bills versus actually, the vision of making a movie?
Yeah, so you may spend, 3 years writing a script, 2 or 3 years raising the money, 3 weeks shooting a film on set, a year in post-production, a year going to film festivals, and a year getting distribution, and then 20 years suing your distributors. So, over the course of what is that, 27, 30 years, all but 3 weeks are spent producing the film, And then hopefully during those 3 weeks of actually shooting the film, you can hand it off to a producing partner while you're focusing on the actors and the camera. So I would love to call myself a director all the time, but as Robert Altman once said to me, what are you? And I said, I'm a director. And he said, well, what was the last film you directed? I said, I don't know, it was like 3 years ago. He goes, well, no, then you're just a guy who has directed. It doesn't make you a director right now. Right now, you're a producer, So you're absolutely right. You spend most of your time producing, however one defines that.
And do you find that your funders do have certain expectations for what the film is going to be? Or are you able to just get money with the promise that at some point, maybe you might make some money and be able to pay them back and make them some money?
So I've really embraced a paradigm shift from calling it investors to calling them backers, much more like you think of backers to Broadway shows. And if we've seen the producers, we know what happens there. But also the crowdfunding and Kickstarter concept, which has been going on for now almost 10 years or so, that helped redefine it. People are backers. You give money, you get a tote bag, you get a mug. It's just like giving money to public radio or your local symphony or opera or something like that. And as one of my producing partners, Mike Ryan, once put it, who's an academic at Emerson now, he calls it cultural capital. And really, that's the thing that we're selling. It's not... There's much better ways to make money if you're an investor. But the cultural capital, are you part of a film that somehow moves the needle in conversation or discourse or for political or social reasons? Is it winning Oscars? Is it winning awards? Do you get to go to film festivals? Do you get to put on a funny hat and go to parties just like You know, and that's why I started with like wine, horse, and boat people are the perfect kinds of investors because they're the ones who have more money than they need. They buy fancy, pretty things, and knowing that they're not going to make money back. Nobody makes money back on a boat, horse, or winery. But they get to wear funny hats and go to cool parties. And that's exactly what film investors or film backers, that should be their expectation. If their expectation is to make money, chances are they will lose money and they will break your kneecap. And so the goal as a filmmaker is to lower their financial expectations, but raise their cultural expectations and say, well, look, we're not going to make money on this thing, but it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to go for a fun ride and you're going to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of, you know, wealthy folks, that's great. That's totally fine. And the nice thing about crowdfunding is it's lowered the barrier to entry. So, you know, someone's got $5, $10, $40, great. They get to be a part of it. They get to see their name in the credits, you know, just a little smaller than the people that had more money.
And Sherry, Dan just used that phrase cultural capital in the earlier days of independent film. And then we can kind of trace this. What have been some of the cultural impacts, the cultural capital impacts that independent film has had? In what ways has it changed the way that we broadly as a society have viewed film and possibly even ways in which we viewed ourselves through film?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question and a very big question, actually. I would be hard put to say now what's happening and with that question, whether people, I feel like it's much more bifurcated now. The whole situation is very bifurcated. You either go to see these, you know, I don't know, bang, bang, blockbuster things, or you go to see something that you hope is going to be of some substantial kind of interest and value. And I think that I guess I'm just sort of stumbling here because I'm trying to think. I do think that because we're not going, the people I kind of hang out with are not necessarily going to Hollywood blockbusters, but are going to these other things, which are somewhere now in between what we thought of as indie films in the 90s and whatever we have now. It's still very important, I think, conversationally to be talking to people about what's going on in these movies. And I think that if you just kind of think about the American kind of what's happening culturally to the American middle class and upper middle class, I suppose, too, because you have to start talking about class issues with independent film. You realize that this is still having an impact, but it's also in a landscape that is really very different from when it started in the late 80s and the 90s. So that would be another study almost. Like, I think you'd really have to do this historically. The kind of cultural capital that we're talking about here was huge, I think, initially, and is still there in many ways. But at the same time, the whole landscape has changed in which this is taking place and in which we can start to think about it. So,
Cynthia, when I think of independent film, I think one of the most amazing things it does, one of the most impressive things it does, is tells narratives of people that we're not used to seeing on film. Sherry just mentioned class. One of the things that independent film has done is told stories, you know, of impoverished people, of marginalized people, stories that we just hadn't seen or heard. And also, by the way, an embrace sometimes of people who are just downright weird, wonderfully weird. Do you think, from a cultural impact perspective, how important is that we're starting to see more narratives of actual people that might be unattractive, might be poor, might be weird, but they are distinctly American, and that's maybe one of the great impacts of independent film? Or am I being too optimistic?
Well, it's difficult for me to say that it's just beginning, because there's a very interesting moment in the post-war period where you have documentaries coming out which are looking at they're sort of they're described as documentaries, but they're sort of fictionalized documentaries, and they will follow one person or a family who whose life is does not fit in, you know, into any sort of Hollywood narrative. Might be a little Navajo boy in Arizona, and it might be, you know, some African American young boy who is living in, you know, New York, Boston, you know, so it's not like it's just started to happen, but I do think that there was a, I will, I mean, independent films are for stories that are about people who don't look like movie stars, whose lives don't fit Hollywood, you know, fairy tale endings, and they're fantastic. It was really interesting to see, in terms of questions of class and labor, in the years surrounding, you know, 2008, 2009, there was a whole series of films that were very specifically about unemployed, underemployed, pushed to the sideline laborers, and all of them are just so such beautiful character studies. So these titles, and maybe you folks know them, things like Ramin Barani's Man Push Cart, about a Pakistani guy who had been a rock star in Lahore, but when he came to the States, he ends up selling coffee in one of those little carts in New York. August Evening is about a Hispanic family. The man is gotten a little bit older, and so he is replaced by a younger laborer. And the story is more complicated than that. Kelly Reichardt's film, Wendy and Lucy. You've got a young woman who's traveling to Alaska to try to find work. And she can't, her car breaks down in Portland, and that, you know, she ends up just completely on her own. Frozen River is about a Mohawk woman who works at a bingo parlor, and a middle-aged single mom who works at a dollar store, and they end up going into smuggling. Because they can drive over the US-Canadian border in the, do you understand? So, I mean, I could just keep going, middle of nowhere, Spa Night. I mean, these are just incredible films, and they're beautifully done. They really look carefully and thoughtfully at questions of class. I'm sorry, I just think they're brilliant.
When we come back, how has independent film changed in recent years? And what are some of the best lesser-known independent films? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How has the major shift towards streaming affected our access to independent films? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. With the recent passing of Robert Redford, it's reminding us that maybe his greatest impact on culture has been his support for independent film. So where has independent film been? Where is it now? And where is it going? Our guest is Sherry Ortner. She's Distinguished Research Professor of Anthropology at UCLA. Cynthia Barron is Professor in the Department of Theater and Film at Bowling Green State University. And Dan Mervish is a director, screenwriter, producer, and author. So I'll ask you this question first. Again, as a filmmaker, when you're thinking about you're making a film and you have to worry about things like distribution, has the advent of all these streaming services and just different ways that those of us who are watching films can watch films, is this giving more of a marketplace, more access for filmmakers to be able to get their product out there so people can see?
Yes and no. Film producer and lawyer John Sloss once said a few years ago, he said, it used to be the odds of getting distribution were like 1%. Now the odds are 100% of getting distribution, but that doesn't mean your film's going to get seen at all. So any idiot can get their film, quote unquote, distributed, but that doesn't mean that people are actually, that eyeballs are actually going to watch it. Like, yeah, you can put your movie on YouTube. Billions of people do that every day. That doesn't mean that they're going to be, you know, winning Oscars. So that is the challenge for indie filmmakers for the last, you know, 20 years as technology has changed. On the one hand, the means of production have changed. You can now shoot a film on a mini, you know, for a while in the late 90s, early 2000s, mini DV. Now you can shoot it on an iPhone if you want. The entry level, the barriers to production have really gone down, which has what Cynthia was saying, that coincided with that wave of filmmaking from new voices and about different kinds of people, and has really diversified the group of people making films. But there is still about the same number of independent films every year that kind of hit a kind of cultural significance. You know, a lot of people are going to talk about and remember are going to win awards. It's, you know, it's about 10 films a year, sort of in that range of indie films. And that hasn't changed, I think, in 30 years, at least, if not more. So the challenges are then, okay, well, how do you get people to see your film? And so, you know, the good news is there are a lot more ways to get people to watch your film. I mean, everything from putting it on YouTube, but you know, on my last film, 18 and a half, our biggest success was getting the film sold to 11 airlines, you know, JetBlue and Virgin Atlantic and Air New Zealand and things like that. Cause you have a captive audience on a plane that don't want to watch, you know, the first three episodes of a bingeable 8-episode series. They'd rather watch a self-contained feature film. And I think, airplanes, weirdly enough, that's where people watch my movie, you know. But then you've also got things like libraries. You know, oddly enough, that's a place where a lot of people, because there's no more Blockbuster, so the only place people can sort of rent movies are libraries. So you've got these other weird things, you know, places that people are seeing films, you know, streaming, but then the whole streaming model changes every couple of years. So 1 year Netflix is buying a ton of indie films, and the next 3 years they're not. But then you have other things like Criterion Channel and Canopy coming up and filling those gaps, again through libraries and university campuses, things like that. And of course, art houses are making a rebirth kind of after, you know, post COVID. They're coming back, and now Gen Z are starting to go to movie theaters more often. So we're back to theatrical being important. And of course, the big thing I always like to talk about is film festivals, you know, getting back to Sundance. Sundance opened the door to there's now thousands of film festivals around the world and certainly in this country. And that is really one of the last places where you can get a packed audience to see an independent film. And if it's a comedy, they laugh, it's a horror, they shriek, you know, and it's a one place where you can really, as a filmmaker, can engage with an audience and do Q&As and hear an audience and they can hear you. And you don't get that on streaming, you don't get that on YouTube, and or even on airplanes.
And somebody on airplanes that's always trying to seek out the films that I haven't heard of, because a lot of times that's the only place you can see them. I'm with you right there. Sherry, you know, you've done research on documentaries, to what we've been talking about. How much does that apply to the production, you know, of these documentaries? And, you know, how much are they reliant on independent financing and the sorts of things we've been talking about?
So actually, I wanted to go back to the question of money and financing directly relevant to this. In a way, I think documentary is much more, as a genre in general, is much more of a continuity of independence. I mean, they do raise their own money. They actually see themselves as independent film saw itself, generally, as, you know, telling the truth, speaking about reality, telling stories that nobody else wants to tell. I mean, they're still in the mindset, in a way, of independent film. And financially, they operate more independently as well. And so they're less pushed around by, you know, by the corporate Hollywood machine and so on. And at the same time, they're hugely important, I think, today in the current political climate, because they're actually looking into all the issues that are part of the, you know, part of the problematic political landscape today, and trying to tell the truth about it. So this is an area where I'm just sort of more, I continue to feel the same passion about documentaries that I felt about independent film itself in general in the first place. I just think it's the place still to, and they've gotten more audience, I think, than they used to have, but that's, it's hard to calculate that.
I have a follow-up, and hopefully this doesn't come too far out of left field, but when you were talking about documentaries, the most recent trend in documentaries now is actually not to produce a film, but to produce miniseries, you know, much longer documentaries. What do you see, either with that as an impact on documentary as a film art? Because a miniseries, it may resemble a film, but they really are two different types of art forms, aren't they?
They are, and I mean, I'm trying to think, can you think of an example? Are you thinking of a particular example with this? Because
some of the most recent really popular documentaries was the Billy Joel documentary that recently came out. That was a series, Pee Wee Herman, Paul Rubens one, that was not done as a film per se, but was done as a multi-part. And of course, when we think of documentaries, you know, even independent and those services, immediately Ken Burns comes to mind, and, you know, he's preparing to release a new one. Those are some of the more recent ones. It seems like the trend to documentaries has been, let's give them 6 hours or 8 hours rather than a 2 hour documentary.
I haven't been watching those because they don't actually work, or at least they don't attract me, and I haven't really put time into them, but I should probably. I know that Kirby Dick, who I think is a wonderful documentarian, is doing a series now, and so I actually was gonna start following what's going on with that. But I'm particularly interested, actually, more, again, coming back to not only the self-contained film, but the screenings, what Dan was saying, I mean, your basic, like, now kind of political documentary, such as the ones that are made by Brave New Films, are almost entirely shown in live screenings. That's their main distribution strategy, is to show them with an audience that's responding and that's asking questions and that's discussing the issues and so forth. So it may be a kind of subgenre of documentary, the very political documentary, kind of pushing that old model of engaging with live audiences, which I think is really important.
And Cynthia, you had some thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to just add that the idea of connections between nonfiction films and particular audiences goes back as far as cinema. And you've got movies being made by and for different unions, you know, different guilds. If you, you know, zipping ahead in time, if you think about Third Cinema, which is a sort of global political movement, you've got a real emphasis on connections between films and audiences and social change. And even, you know, the one of the earliest opportunities for, well, you know, American sort of engaged documentary filmmaking is The Plow That Broke the Plains, and by Per Lorenz. And, you know, at the time, you know, this film that had received, you know, funding, you know, Depression era funding, you know, and it was assumed, the filmmakers assumed that it would be distributed by Hollywood studios. And they're like, we don't do that. We don't. You want to talk about problems in the food system, or, you know, connections between government policies and maybe, you know, ecological problems? They're like, no, we don't do that. And that was one of the first clear signs that there would never be any connection between political filmmaking and Hollywood. You know, it was just so clear. So, you know, what is this, 1936 or something? Mm-hmm. So it's funny.
Yeah. Although, by the way, political filmmaking can make money. Michael Moore's documentaries and Morgan Spurlock demonstrate they could make money, you know, later. But that, are those the examples that kind of prove the rule, by the way?
And because they have, I mean, they're, you know, they're their own kind of sort of political theater, right? Mm. You've got the entertainer, showman, right? It's confrontative, you know. And then, you know, if you want to think more widely, I mean, the films that are being created by the Steve Bannons of the world, those are big money makers. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to get their whatever latest conspiracy theory DVD. Mm-hmm. It's a whole universe, and there's money.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about independent filmmaking and the legacy of Robert Redford and the Sundance Film Festival. Our guests today are Sherry Ortner of UCLA, Cynthia Barron of Bowling Green State University, and Dan Mervis. She's a director, screenwriter, producer, and author, also of Chapman University. And Dan, I want to come back to this question about film festivals, because you actually are a co-founder of a film festival. First of all, did you do that so that you had some place where you could screen your own films? And how important are these festivals themselves at just getting audiences interested in independent film, as well as, of course, discovering these films?
Yeah, by 1995, which is about when I finished my first film, Sundance was far and away the most preeminent U.S. festival, and really had kind of a lock on international festivals and other regional U.S. festivals. They would just take that Sundance catalog of 12 films every year and go, oh, okay, I guess these are the indie films this year from America. And because of that, I came around with my first film called Omaha the Movie in like mid-1994. We finished the film, got together with a bunch of other filmmakers. We all thought we were going to go to Sundance, and then we didn't. And that was because there was an increasing number of indie films being made. Sundance had not increased the number of films they were taking. They still had some pretty small sections. And they were starting to go Hollywood. They were like, oh, wow, let's show films with bigger budgets and bigger stars and by second-time directors. And they had kind of left behind the niche of filmmakers like me, the first-time filmmakers who had been inspired by kind of that first generation of Sundance filmmakers like Steven Soderbergh and Robert Rodriguez and Richard Linklater. And so that's when my friends and I decided to start Slam Dance, which started in January 95, literally 30 feet down the hall from Sundance. And they weren't happy. And Robert Redford called us parasites. And that was the best street cred we could ever get. But he was right. I mean, we were taking advantage of their situation, but we didn't really have a choice in the matter. That was, if you didn't go to Sundance, you wouldn't get distribution, you wouldn't get an agent, you wouldn't get a girlfriend. I mean, you were done. You know, that was the end of your career. And so we really felt like we had to go there. And then once we were there, we realized we were kind of filling this niche that needed filling of, for the first time, indie filmmakers with low budgets and films that didn't have distribution. And so we decided to keep doing it. And now 31 years later, we're still doing it. And along the way, we've shown the first films of everyone from Bong Joon-ho, Chris Nolan, the Russo brothers, the late Lynn Shelton, Sean Baker, the Safdie brothers, the Russo brothers, a lot of brothers, a few sisters in there as well. Anyway, the point is, a lot of great filmmakers have shown their first films at Slamdance, and then very often then their second films will play at Sundance. And I think eventually Redford and a lot of the folks at Sundance realized, oh, these Slamdance guys are actually a pretty good farm team for us, because we kind of train the filmmakers to come to Park City, and the ones that did well at Sundance tended to be the ones whose first films were at Slamdance, because they kind of knew where to stay and what publicists to hire and that sort of thing. So, but around that same time, around 95, we weren't the only ones, you know, thinking along those lines. That was around the same time that South by Southwest started their film festival. They've been a music festival for 10 years. They started in 94. You know, Hampton started, New York Underground, Chicago Underground, LA Independent Film Festival started. So a lot of communities around the country were realizing, hey, we want our own show. You know, we want our own festival. This looks like fun. And that kind of spread the wealth a little bit. But that said, Sundance is still the first and foremost film festival where people want to premiere their film.
And Cynthia, I want to ask you, we started off talking about Robert Redford, and I know you've given some thoughts and have some things to say about what Redford actually did to promote voices that we hadn't really seen in mainstream. I know one in television, because in Indigenous people, something that's getting a lot of buzz right now is the series Dark Winds. How much was this? It was more than just creating a film festival. It was literally reaching out to who he saw were more marginalized or less represented communities within the industry, that he actually used his own cultural capital as a way to get some of these films and TV series made.
One of the things that's really interesting, and I know the most about the Native and Indigenous program, so I will speak to that. There are other things that the Sundance Institute has done, and there's other things that Redford has done. You know, he directed Milagro Beanfield Wars and so forth. But about the Native and Indigenous program that's connected to the Sundance Institute, it actually goes back to the 90s, and actually Canadian Indigenous actor Gary Farmer was a consultant to Sundance as early as 1986. But the Native and Indigenous program was transformative for Indigenous filmmaking globally. Because you have Mirada Mita, who is a Maori filmmaker. She is a mentor from 2000 to 2009. And one of the key figures is Bird Running Water, who was the director of the program from 2001 to 2022. And he would go around the globe and meet with emerging filmmakers, people who had been showing their films at Indigenous film festivals and so forth. And they were brought together at the Institute. And so you've got somebody like Sterling Harjo, arriving with his first short film in 2004, which is the same year that Taika Waititi arrives with his first short film. And I could just go on with the number of Indigenous filmmakers who found a home and connection at Sundance. But I do want to note that the Sundance was not their only home. There were Indigenous festivals that were established in the 70s at the same time that there were festivals for Black filmmakers, Asian American filmmakers, Hispanic Latino filmmakers, queer filmmakers, women filmmakers. So there was this big rise in the 1970s. And then, and what I credit the folks at Sundance with doing is not trying to replace those festivals, but instead to provide more support and for a whole range of filmmakers, which was really, really beneficial.
We've got just a couple minutes left, and I had one last question that I promised everybody. Shara, I'll start with you. What's one or a couple independent films that probably our listeners, and I'm doing this strictly for me, I'm making a list of these are the movies that I need to see. What would you recommend as just fabulous films that you think we should all see?
I would go to documentary for my big favorites. I would say I've mentioned several filmmakers, almost anything by Kirby Dick, I think is just outstanding. There was a filmmaker who made only a few movies, but they were sort of stunning, named Charles Ferguson, who made a spectacular film about Wall Street. I'm not remembering the title. It had people who had a lot of dollar bills on the cover of the DVD. And I guess most recently I've been working on and watching the amazing films of Brave New Films, Robert Greenwald, films about the contemporary political landscape, which I think have been very, very powerful. So
that's wonderful. Cynthia, I'll ask you, I'll let Dan go last. You have made some recommendations, so you've already done some of the heavy lifting, but what are a couple of films that you haven't mentioned that just should be on everybody's short list?
Oh, this is rough. This is rough. I have so many favorites. It's impossible to choose. Well, let me see. I certainly would suggest people getting to know films by Deborah Granik. They may have seen Winter's Bone, just because it was, you know, a star became a star vehicle, but all of her films are quite lovely. I think that there's also, Gus Van Sant's films. There's really a panoply of interesting ones. People might know his mainstream ones, but he has a whole range of really interesting films. And then more off the beaten track, I would recommend that people seek out films by filmmakers associated with what is now called the LA Rebellion. That is not what they called themselves. These are filmmakers who came out of the UCLA Ethnocommunications Program in the 70s and 80s. People might know the work of Charles Burnett. They probably have heard of Killer of Sheep, but I think films by Haile Gerima, something like Bush Mama, a person's got to see that sometime in their lifetime, I think.
Oh, that's wonderful. Dan, what would be some of your recommendations?
Well, I can go super obscure. Some films from our early Slamdance years. Everyone's heard of Christopher Nolan and maybe have seen his first film, Following, which you probably can find. What they will have a much harder time finding is the film that beat that film for our grand jury prize that year, which was a little film called Shy Girl, C-H-I, by my friend Heidi Van Leer, who's actually shooting her new film literally as we speak. But look for the first films of a lot of these great filmmakers. Look for Bong Joon-ho's Barking Dogs Never Bite, the Russo Brothers' Pieces, which is hard to find. Ryan Johnson's first short film, which I think he was an undergrad at USC when I was a grad student. I helped teach him how to cut negative, called Evil Demon Golf Ball from Hell. You can find that on YouTube, I think. One of the OG Slamdance films by my friends Lisa Raven and Frank Hudak was called Low, black and white film. Matthew Harrison's film that actually was at Sundance in 95. Rhythm Thief's great film. And I think that's on Criterion now. So Anyway, the point is, there's a ton of films. And then there's obscure Colorado filmmaker who did this film called Snapple. There's a great Ecuadorian film called The Porcelain Horse by my friend Javi, who went to Colombia. So it's sort of a U.S. film, even though he's in Ecuador. There's just go to film festivals. That's all I'm going to say, because a lot of everybody thinks everything is available everywhere on every streaming service, and that simply isn't true. I'm literally staring at my negative from my first film, Omaha the Movie, and I have taken it off every streaming service. It is only available in my living room. We're trying to get it scanned now, but we're trying to find someone to pay for that and a distributor, and Criterion Channel won't return our phone calls. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there. So look for it. Go to your local film festival. See an obscure film that you'll never see again.
I want to thank you all for a wonderful conversation. Our guests today have been Sherry Ortner. She's Distinguished Research Professor of Anthropology at UCLA. She's the author of Not Hollywood, Independent Film at the Twilight of the American Dream, and Screening Social Justice, Brave New Films, and Documentary Activism. Cynthia Barron is professor in the Department of Theater and Film at Bowling Green State University. She's the author of Modern Acting, the Lost Chapter of American Film and Theater, and the co-author of Acting Indie, Industry, Aesthetics, and Performances. And Dan Mervis, he's a director, screenwriter, producer, and author. And two films I have to admit I haven't seen, but I'm going to track down, 18 and a Half, and Bernard and Huey. He's directed those two films. He's also written The Cheerful Subversive's Guide to Independent Filmmaking. I want to thank you all so much for sharing your time and your expertise. This has been, you know, quite the enjoyment. And I can honestly say, I'm flashing the list here, I have a nice long list of films that are on my must-see list. Thanks to all of you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Douglas. Nice to meet you all.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.